Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, we'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. Live or on demand, we'll bring you the stories that keep you informed and ahead of the game. Coming up on the program today, empowerment versus access as Starlink sparks a tough policy debate. Crypto moving ahead as global merchants increasingly embrace digital payment. Digging deeper into mining's future and South Africa's sustainability challenge, the big question, is it working? And tobacco's iron grip exposed as health experts target workplace risk. It's Friday, the 30th of May. Now let's start with this and the Communications Minister Sali Malatsi's proposal to relax broad-based black economic empowerment rules for satellite operators has predictably ignited something of a storm. His supporters are calling it necessary and pragmatic, but his critics are suggesting that it is a rollback of transformation. The Minister joins me now. Minister, thank you very much indeed. I appreciate your time today. Are you giving Silicon Valley a free pass on transformation?
Absolutely not. And it is important to clarify that there isn't any clandestine or explicit effort to relax transformation laws in the country. What I'm advocating for, or the question that I want resolved with the introduction of this policy directive, is to ensure that all the provisions of empowerment options that are outlined clearly in the Broad-Based Black Economic Empowerment Act are applicable in the ICT sector at all times and consistently. Because the question that we are trying to answer here, Jeremy, is that there is inconsistencies in terms of the provisions of the BBBE Act and the sector codes, which outline very specifically that for multinationals seeking to enter the space, there are two avenues of potentially doing so. One, it is by seizing 30% of their ownership to local residents, or through the equity equivalent program vehicle. Yet in 2021, when ICASA, who is the regulator in the ICT sector and broadcasting space, introduced ownership regulations around licensing ownership in the telecommunication space, they focused on one element of equity, which is ownership, instead of the full bouquet of those options. And we want to harmonize those two so that they speak to the letter and the spirit of what the sector codes seek to achieve.
Minister, the sense that people are getting, though, is that you're wanting to prioritize global tech players over South African transformation and effectively suggesting that foreign firms are getting exemptions that black South Africans are not going to get.
No, and it's unfortunate conclusion, because it seems to reach a conclusion that is informed by a fear of misrepresentation based on people's views. Because, Jeremy, you know very well that there are multinationals in the ICT space who are operating in South Africa without being owned, or without 30% of their businesses being owned by local South Africans. These include Microsoft, which earlier this year, by the way, announced a multi-million investment in South Africa through the equity equivalent program. IBM is in South Africa through that vehicle. So this provision is to make sure that the inconsistency that applies in terms of the regulations in the telecommunication space can align with the rest of the sector, so that ultimately the same rules in the same sector are applicable to all players. So there wouldn't be any exemption whatsoever towards any player or any region.
Could you point to any hard evidence that broad-based black economic empowerment has deterred satellite investment?
No. So I wouldn't be able to at this stage, right? Because what we are seeking to answer, and your question is very important because it seeks to understand why then do you want to open up this option to be applicable is there isn't appetite for that. But my point of departure is informed by the fact that this is a legislative requirement that is there, but somehow the regulator at one point decided to close out that option, and that is not regulatory fairness because it represents a departure from the existing legislation. And when you speak about regulatory reform, it is about ensuring that all the options that close up opportunities for all players to participate are removed so that there are not those obstacles. And by removing them, it does not represent a deviation from existing legislation, but rather to say that this hurdle was introduced when it shouldn't have been introduced.
Let me come back to Starlink. Did the organization lobby your department directly?
No, absolutely not.
And the suggestion that you're making, is it cabinet approved at this point, or is there a sense here that you're just freelancing on empowerment, that you're out on a limb here?
No, I'm not freelancing at all, Jeremy. And the good thing about this whole debate is that the medium-term development policy, which is government 5-year statement of its intention, which encapsulates all the plans and the 5-year strategic plans for all government departments, includes, because we made this submission when we made the submission for the Department of Communications and Digital Technologies, that we want the full recognition of equity equivalent programs in the ICT sector to be a target for the department for the 5-year period. And you would know that the debate around the MTD plan did not take place over one session on one meeting, because it started shortly after the Government of National Unity was formed, and it was adopted earlier this year. So it aligns perfectly with the ambitions and the plans and the policies of the Government of National Unity.
Could you give me a sense, though, of what the temperature is like among your cabinet colleagues right now in terms of this proposal? Is there broad support, or is there a growing sense of discomfort? And we are sensing the latter.
No, in cabinet, I mean, cabinet met earlier this week, and you would know cabinet meetings are confidential, so we don't discuss those, the outcomes of those publicly. But if you follow the statement that the minister in the presidency, Kumbuzo Ntshavheni, issued on or the response that she shared with the public when she was asked about the question, and also take into consideration the statement made by the president earlier this week at Infrastructure South Africa's conference, and the comments by Minister Park Stau, who is the Minister of Trade, Industry and Competition, that is responsible for the enforcement of, you know, equity equivalent programs. There's alignment, because equity equivalent programs are national policy. They are not some invention by Solima Ladzi that just came into the fore last week or 2 weeks ago.
And Minister, you are prepared, of course, to commit to a full, transparent public consultation before there is finalization on this, I assume.
Absolutely, as is required by law, and also as it is my way of operating. There is nothing to hide, and that's why we've been communicating even publicly. Even when the Gazette was gazetted, we released a public statement to say this is the step that we are on now with the gazetting, and public comments will be taking place for the next 30 days. And based on the volume or the size of those public comments, it will inform how long it will take to go throughout them. And those public comments will eventually also be public, you know.
Are you disappointed at the firestorm that's been created around this issue?
No, I'm not disappointed. I think, you know, we have to understand that the conversation of transformation, conversation of empowerment in South Africa will always invoke strong emotions. I am disappointed only at the attempts to paint this move as a departure from, you know, the country's transformation objectives, because it speaks directly to that, because equity equivalent programs offer, you know, the requirements for them is that it offers, you know, investment in job creation and infrastructure, research and development, doing business with local suppliers, and in this case, you know, investment towards closing the digital divide to ensure that we can get broadband connectivity to many communities, such as the rural areas where I come from and still live, and, you know, townships and farming communities and mining communities, so that we get South Africa. There are currently over 22 million South Africans who are not connected to the internet or broadband connectivity. And that's where the efforts are geared towards. You know, the other stuff about the distortion of facts by some political parties, I think there is a lot of audience exhibitioning that is taking place, that is understandable, but it is only when, you know, the facts get in the way of propaganda that my disappointment has taken place.
Communications Minister Solly Malatsi, thank you very much for talking to me.
Remember when you had to hurry up and wait, and cars could only run on fossil fuels? Well, hurry up and catch up. You don't need diesel power, you just need a second electric motor. With Volvo plug-in hybrids, you can drive electric in the city, switch to fuel for the long haul, or combine both when you want it all. So what are you waiting for? You're late for your test drive. It's safe to be brave with Volvo.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
In a landmark shift for global commerce, crypto payments have officially outpaced Visa and MasterCard in transaction volume, with the US dollar-backed stablecoins transferring something in the region of $27 trillion last year alone. And South Africa, I think, is also riding this wave as well. Major retailers like Pick n Pay are now accepting Bitcoin. Local exchanges are partnering with platforms like Zapper to make crypto a more everyday option. So let's try and lift the curtain on this. Let's try and understand what this means for the future of retail, for regulation and financial inclusion. And welcome back to the program, Vihan Ulofia, partner and fintech and digital assets lead at Forvis Mazars South Africa. Vihan, always good to talk to you. Let's start with that big headline, crypto payments surpassing Visa and MasterCard. What, in your opinion, then, is driving this massive surge in adoption?
Yeah, Jeremy, thanks so much for having me again today. I think the reason for the increase in the utilization of fiat-backed stable coins is specifically as a result of the advantages that blockchain technology offers those utilizing the asset class itself. I mean, even from a South African standpoint, if you look at how big our migrant workforce is in South Africa and the movement of funds across the border from South Africa back to other rural areas in Africa, I mean, there's real benefit for them to utilize the asset class for cross-border payments and remittances in addition to payments. I think there's a wealth of technological advances that can be used using stable coins, specifically in relation to the lower costs compared to traditional facilitators of those payments. I think that's the real advantage that we're looking at from a US dollar-backed stablecoin perspective.
And I see that South Africa is now ranked 14th globally in crypto payment acceptance. Yeah. Again, what makes our market particularly ripe for this kind of innovation, and do you see this accelerating?
Yeah, I think Africa in its entirety is quite underbanked and underserved. So from that perspective, there is real potential for the asset class to make a significant impact in South Africa. I mean, based on the information that we receive from SARS and Statistica, 5.8 million South Africans currently utilize or hold cryptocurrency, and that's expected to reach about just over 6 million by the end of this year. I mean, that's, I think in total, it's about $388 million in unspent crypto assets. And I think the nature of South African residents as well also pushes them to innovate and find new ways to use the technology to their advantages and of course, all the efficiency that the technology itself offers.
There's no doubt, and I'm sure you'll agree, that Pick n Pay's decision to accept Bitcoin, I think at over 2,000 stores, was a pivotal moment. But do you think it's going to trigger a wider ripple effect in local retail, or are they still outriders at this point?
So it'll be interesting to see whether the adoption in South Africa continues on that trajectory. But I mean, from Pick n Pay's perspective, if you think about the technology being utilized, even though you're able to pay in Bitcoin for your groceries, it utilizes a side chain called the Bitcoin Lightning Network. And it's quite interesting to see. I think the Lightning Network is able to facilitate about 1 billion transactions per second. I mean, the cost of the transaction is less than 1 cent. So now you see instances, I think if I'm correct now, that the transaction fees associated when you pay with Bitcoin as opposed to a Visa or MasterCard card or in any other bank, I think it's currently sitting at about 1%, where you traditionally pay about 2.5%. Of course, that part gets passed on to the merchants to pick up that cost. But I mean, if you utilize something like the Lightning Network, it will effectively push down those costs over the long term as well, making it more efficient and, of course, putting the funds back into the pockets of the merchants and even the customers themselves as well.
But we're not quite there yet, because your report also highlights that most South Africans still treat crypto as an investment and not a payment tool, as you've outlined. What do you think is holding people back?
So it's difficult to say as well. I mean, even though the asset class was designed to facilitate peer-to-peer payments, I mean, there's various characteristics that also contributed to it being a store of value and more speculative asset. And the problem with that is South Africans are not necessarily willing to part ways with their investments. So when you've got an asset class that's outperforming any other asset, utilizing that to pay for groceries is difficult in terms of overcoming that mindset of the individual actually holding the cryptocurrency. So I think once you get a nice ripe environment where people actually receive remuneration in Bitcoin, they'll probably be more willing to spend it as well. So I think that needs to transition over the long term to get that mass adoption in terms of paying for everyday goods and services in cryptocurrency, be it Bitcoin or fiat-backed stablecoins.
So you're still seeing it as long term. It's going to take some time before crypto is pushed from fringe payments into the mainstream mass market.
Yeah, definitely the case. But I mean, we always take the comparison in terms of the internet and seeing the crypto adoption. I mean, crypto adoption is on the same trajectory as the utilization of internet. And I think if you go back to the 90s, fast forward to today, it's integrated into every single facet of our lives. So I do expect cryptocurrencies to do the same. But of course, it is going to take time. We need that adoption and buy-in from various retailers and merchants as well to accept cryptocurrency as a form of payment. But I mean, we do have a regulated environment, so it does protect those stakeholders involved in the industry. And of course, that's also a major catalyst to drive this adoption forward.
Let me pick you up on that then. From an operational perspective, what are the challenges or the difficulties that businesses will face, and particularly in the retail space, when integrating crypto payment into their systems?
Yeah, so currently as it stands, it's difficult to integrate cryptocurrency into the ERP system of the business actually accepting cryptocurrency, because they don't necessarily always want to hold the cryptocurrency on their balance sheet. But we have seen a change in the views of those accepting cryptocurrency actually willing to hold it on their balance sheet. But we do require integration of the existing accounting packages and point of sale systems to facilitate the introduction of cryptocurrency, so it just seamlessly integrates into the entire ecosystem from a financial reporting point of view. So that is definitely a hurdle to overcome, but I know there are people in the background working on aspects to facilitate that going forward, so you have a more seamless integration.
Another hurdle, and this is a final question to you, is volatility. It's a long-standing concern as far as the concept is concerned. Are businesses becoming a little bit more adept in managing the risk when accepting digital assets at the till?
Yeah, so usually with individuals or actually accepting it at the till, they have a mechanism in place where it's liquidated immediately, so they don't keep it on their balance sheet for long-term capital appreciation. But I mean, it comes back to the fundamental principle in terms of arguing whether cryptocurrency is money, because it needs to be a store of value, it needs to be a medium of exchange, and it needs to be a unit of account. And it ticks all those boxes except for that unit of account as a result of the volatility. But that's where elements such as US dollar-backed stablecoins and even ZAR-backed stablecoins can fulfill that, to make sure that volatility is basically closed out. So you have a digital currency that's backed to a fiat currency that doesn't expose you to that volatility, but gives you the advantage of all the various intricacies the technology has to offer.
Thank you very much indeed. That's Vihan Olufia, partner and fintech and digital assets lead at Forvis Mazars South Africa. Appreciate your time. Thank you.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, sustainability is said to be the new license to operate, but in South Africa, where communities are often restless and exploration budgets are tight, my question is mining really evolving fast enough? There is a new report that suggests that ethical exploration must be at the heart of a more responsible industry. And in that respect, I'm joined now by Zinzi Lawrence, Senior Associate, Natural Resources and Environment at ENS. And I want to interrogate what sustainability means in real terms and who is really accountable. So, Zinzi, a very warm welcome. So maybe let's start with a broad overview. What does sustainable mining mean in a country that is facing chronic energy shortages and, as I've referenced often, in many cases, social unrest?
Thank you very much, Jeremy, for that question. So sustainability, if we look at it, it's a whole encompassing concept. So you need to think about, you know, ensuring that you're mining in accordance with the legislation and your approved authorizations. You are also ensuring that when you mine, your impact on the environment, even though they may be negative, there are some mitigation measures that you're putting in place to ensure that you don't harm the environment. In addition, you are ensuring that your social stakeholders, so your community stakeholders, are also catered for in your operations. And that in itself starts with, you know, ensuring that you consult with them before you even start with your projects. And that is what the legislation already provides for. So ensuring that you consult meaningfully with your stakeholders and that they actually understand what it is that you're going to be doing on the area or the host mining area. In addition, making sure that, you know, your governance is in place and that everything that you are doing, you are accounting for. And so also submitting reports to the regulator to ensure that you account for all your operations. So that's broadly what sustainability means when you are conducting mining operations in South Africa.
And Zinzi, in theory, it all sounds very laudable, but I would suggest to you that often that is simply not happening fast enough because there is a balance between economic imperative on the one hand and making a profit, and on the other hand, adhering to those very lofty principles.
Most certainly. And what we are experiencing is that, you know, mining companies actually do want to comply. I think we find ourselves now in an environment where environmental social governance issues are very important. And even for your investors and your shareholders, it's something that is now given priority. And so what we are finding is that mining companies genuinely want to comply, but there are, of course, challenges. And some of these include, you know, the bureaucracy that they then face when they apply for titles, when they apply for authorizations, and the turnaround times around that. And then, of course, in addition with the communities, it's not always easy operating within a community because you need to understand the dynamics of the community. And at times there are factions within communities and you find you think you have consulted, but it turns out you've been consulting with the wrong faction. And we've seen how that plays out in practice with, you know, mine communities challenging titles that have been issued on the basis that they were not consulted. And you find yourself having to go back. Yeah, just when you think you've secured an authorization, you need to go back and start again. And of course, that then impacts on your investment because especially at the exploration stage where there really isn't capital and you don't want to then be drawn away from the project and now focusing on, you know, the sideshows of I need to ensure that I go back and consult. I need to ensure that I'm defending any objections that are being raised in respect of my title. So, yes, it sounds good in theory, but in practice, it's a lot more nuanced and a lot more challenging. And that's why it's very important that even at the start of a project, you make sure that you do consult the people that you need to consult, but also seeking advice and making sure that you understand the area that you'll be operating in.
Where then do you think industry is failing the most? Is it around the environment? Is it around community engagement or transparency of practice?
Yeah, so I think it's a combination of factors. Insofar as the environment is concerned, I think we've got, robust legislation that already tells us what we need to do. The issue becomes when you need to then secure those authorizations. As I said, the turnaround time, sometimes it can take you up to 300 days, for example, to secure a water use license. And it is around those, bureaucracies, if we can cut down on the red tape. But also we're finding that even with communities, because they've become so sophisticated, it's not just a tick box exercise anymore. So it's, I think the industry on its own must, everyone must, it's a collaborative approach that we must all say we want to make this industry work. We need to come together to ensure that we get it to the place that it needs to. And we were just at the Junior Indaba 2 days ago, and what we're hearing from the presentations is that people are finding that, going to apply elsewhere in other or conduct operations in other countries is more preferable than to South Africa because of the issues that we face, the red tape and the issues of double grants of titles. And so as a country, we need to now step back and see where we can improve, but also maybe borrow from some of our neighbors that we've heard are doing great things and they don't have as long lead times to issue authorizations and the like.
But until that paradigm changes, current ESG metrics, I would suggest to you, will remain just that, box-ticking exercises for investor relations.
Yeah, so I guess for me, ESG, yes, it's a new buzzword that we're all using, but as far as, mining legislation is concerned, we have always had these requirements. It's just they're now packaged as ESG. The only challenge that we've had was, with enforcement, getting the regulator to actually ensure that people are complying. And, there are, of course, mining companies that do want to comply that actually go above and beyond, your ESG metrics. Of course, there'll always be one or two that fall behind or try to cut corners. But I do think that we've always had the framework for it. And genuinely, there are mining companies that actually do go above and beyond meeting those metrics. And now that it's something that even investors are looking at, I think it's even been elevated and it's being incorporated into, mining companies' policies and the way of doing business.
I'm going to leave it there with my appreciation. That is Zinzi Lawrence, Senior Associate, Natural Resources and Environment at ENS. Thank you.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, as World No Tobacco Day approaches, maybe it's time to strip some of the glamour from one of the world's deadliest habits. With over 8 million deaths annually and 1.3 million from secondhand smoke, tobacco, it's clear to see, remains a clear and present danger, particularly in our homes and workplaces. I want to talk now to Dr. Chris von Straten, Global Health Advisor, Clinical Governance at International SOS. I'm going to ask him why nicotine is still, it seems, winning the battle for hearts, lungs, and minds. So, Chris, a very warm welcome to you. And maybe the starting point here is why we're still falling for tobacco marketing in 2025.
So, Jeremy, it's a, well, you phrased that well, and it packs a punch. I think, first off, we need to acknowledge that nicotine is one of the most addictive substances known to man. It's right up there. If you look at what scientists regard as first and second place, it's heroin and cocaine, and nicotine comes in about third place. So it alone is very addictive. It stimulates a part of the brain that makes you release dopamine. That, for a short period of time, makes you feel calm. Some people, it makes you feel, not euphoric, but let's say you feel good. The other aspect, and I hate to admit this, but in my first career, I was a musician, and I certainly started smoking because I was surrounded by people that I considered to be cool. They were cool. We were making music. We were often stressed. We would have a cigarette before we performed or afterwards as a social relaxation. So I think if you bundle that together, you've got a very real physiological addiction. It is an addiction. Nicotine is powerfully addictive. And you also have people that are self-medicating for stress. I've heard many patients and colleagues and people trying to quit say, "Dr. Chris, it makes me feel good." But the problem is this, it makes them feel good for a short period of time, and then they start getting anxious again because they're not getting the dopamine hit, and they revert back to the cigarettes. So I think it's all that tying together brings us to a point, and the very slick marketing has led to the point we're currently at.
And Chris, there is a preponderance of evidence about the dangers, as you have alluded to. I wonder if the anti-smoking movement, though, has become either a little too polite or has simply been shunted to the margins.
Good question. It is complex. One wants to approach this, I think, tactfully and with sensitivity to people's rights and beliefs. But there is absolutely no doubt that smoking, especially in the long term, has significant impact on your body. It damages your vasculature, your small arteries in your body, and that will lead to macular degeneration, blindness, heart attacks, stroke, osteoporosis, COPD, frequent infections. And just to make sure people are aware too, it leads to infertility, erectile dysfunction. The more older you get, and for women who are pregnant, miscarriage, birth defects, and developmental delays. So these are not small or insignificant. It's a very real burden and very real risk.
So do you think current warnings go far enough these days, or do we need to up the ante?
Good question. I do think we need to up the ante, and I think, though, it needs to be culturally specific and also direct to the right context. I'll give you an example. In the UK, their laws are very strict. The advertising, in fact, on boxes of cigarettes will have someone who's losing a toe to gangrene and it's going to be amputated. Or they show an eye that has now become blind. So that's step one. Two, yes, I do think media, and if you look at some of the advertising that has been in the media at large, has sometimes looked very suave and slick. And I do think the law and legislation needs to come into play. I also believe firmly, because it's what I do, but what I increasingly believe in, the workplace and what we can do in the workplace to educate, inform and empower.
You talk about communication being more culturally specific. What specifically do you mean by that?
Yeah, it's a good question. And again, Jeremy, what I do, because I am an Uber nerd, I look at global patterns and trends and programs that have been effective but in different countries. So if you look at what's happening in France this week, the Minister of Health is looking to enact very specific legislation around no smoking, even in public places like beaches, especially where there are kids. Because I hope you can ask the questions now about secondhand and third-hand smoke. But we know that secondhand and third-hand smoke really damages kids badly. So there, the communication on that's very open, it's very French, it's very direct. If you look at what's been happening in the UK, they've taken a very UK subtle approach around the languaging and around trying to promote it. In South Africa, and when I was working in the townships in Khayelitsha and around parts of Cape Town and the Cape Flats, we needed to make sure it was the right language, speaking Xhosa, or making sure that someone is explaining, hey, this makes you feel good now, but explaining in the right kind of language and the right kind of level so people got it. Does that make sense? Mm.
To your point then, secondhand smoke, particularly in workplaces, it's a hidden occupational hazard, isn't it?
It is, and it's one that I personally underestimated when I was a young clinician. So I think it's pretty obvious. If you're in a vehicle with someone who's smoking and you're directly inhaling that smoke, we know that the secondary smoke and the individual getting that gets a very high dose of nicotine and the other chemicals. And there's 7,000 different chemicals that people inhale from secondhand smoke, and they are carcinogenic. They can and will damage your microvasculature and make you sick. Third-hand smoke, and this is something I've only really picked up on the last couple of years, third-hand smoke is the chemical deposits that will happen in especially a car or a building where people smoke. And it forms a chemical layer, especially on, for example, carpets or toys, and kids now come in close contact with that, will start picking up these chemicals, and it is detrimental.
Well, you couldn't be more blunt about the warning ahead of World No Tobacco Day. Thank you very much indeed. That's Dr. Chris van Straaten, Global Health Advisor, Clinical Governance at International SOS. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We're here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.